Amid the coronavirus pandemic, U.S. communities are restricting pool and beach access, raising questions of who gets to swim this summer.
There's been a long history of exclusionary practices across the U.S., and oftentimes these had a disproportionate impact on working families and people of color.
I'm Tanzina Vega, and that's today on The Takeaway for July 7th. Also, while books about race are flying off the shelves, one author says fiction can teach us even more about Black lives.
Reading fiction that's not just about white people, people in your own country, but fiction about Black people and Black lives does a lot to change your perspective.
We begin the show with domestic workers and how hard they've been hit economically due to the coronavirus. As the country heads into the fifth month of the coronavirus pandemic, many people have limited the number of visitors they allow into their homes. That means no family get-togethers or dinners with friends. But that's also included domestic workers like housekeepers, nannies, and home health aides. In early April, a study by the National Domestic Workers Alliance found that more than 70% of the workers they surveyed had lost all of their usual jobs and wages for the coming week. And in recent months, even as some industries have gradually reopened, many domestic workers are still in an economic bind as families try to balance the risk of opening their homes with the overwhelming need for help. And for the domestic workers who are still employed, concerns about contracting COVID-19 remain. 25% of the workers surveyed in June by the Institute for Policy Studies either experienced or lived with someone who has experienced coronavirus symptoms. All this is hitting women of color especially hard, as they make up the vast majority of domestic workers in the United States. Assessing the risks faced by domestic workers during this pandemic and the way ahead is where we start today. Joining me now is Kimberly Freeman Brown, co-author of the report Notes from the Storm, Black Immigrant Domestic Workers in the Time of COVID-19 from the Institute for Policy Studies. Kimberly, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you for having me, Tanzina.
Also with us is Caitlin Dickerson, immigration reporter for the New York Times. Caitlin, welcome back.
Hi, Tanzina. Thanks. Good to be with you.
So, Caitlin, you spoke with a number of undocumented domestic workers who had lost work at the end of March. What were some of their employers telling them at the time?
It was really coming quite simply, you know, in the form of a text message, maybe a phone call saying, you know, please don't come into work tomorrow. That was a message that nannies received, that house cleaners received, that gardeners received, which sounds like a casual message, but it's a really big deal to somebody who really has almost no discretionary money, who has no extra money beyond what they need to make their bills. And it's only really continued, you know, as you pointed out, when the country closed down, social distancing was the first rule of thumb. As a result, people asked their nannies to stay home, asked their house cleaners to stay home. And these workers rely on handshake deals for their employment in many cases. They're often paid in cash, which means they didn't have any contractual or legal entitlement to anything like sick pay or vacation days. And, you know, the situation is only compounded by the fact that workers, especially those who don't have legal status, who work in the domestic sphere, were not eligible for federal stimulus money. And two, as the economy now contracts, domestic workers are really the first discretionary expense to go. And so not only did domestic workers lose their work first, but their hopes of getting it back really for many feel quite low.
Kimberly, you co-authored the survey we mentioned at the top of Black immigrant domestic workers in New York City, Miami, and Massachusetts. Tell me about what some of the findings were in those three different areas with this group.
We surveyed 811 Black immigrant domestic workers in the three locations that you mentioned. 70% of those who responded to our survey in those three locations reported that they had either lost their jobs or received reduced hours and pay. And in Miami, for example, it was the worst. 93% of respondents reported having lost wages or having lost their jobs. Housing insecurity was another big issue that we saw. 65% of respondents said that they are fearful or at risk of eviction or utility shut off in the next 3 months, facing, you know, their worst fears of, you know, being without a home or without utilities.
This is an industry that really is dominated by women of color. Black women, Latina women, Asian women, and many of these women are also undocumented. Did your survey responses differ from undocumented versus documented workers in terms of their fears?
We saw, Tanzina, that in almost every area where we surveyed Black immigrant domestic workers, that undocumented workers reported even worse conditions. So, for example, with job loss, undocumented workers were nearly twice as likely as documented workers to be terminated.
Caitlin, did you find similar experiences in your reporting? Because you've spoken with a woman named Enriqueta, who's undocumented, who had been working as a house cleaner until the pandemic started. Tell us a little bit about her experience.
Enriqueta, she lives in Austin, Texas. She and her husband were both house cleaners and lost their jobs immediately in mid-March when the virus broke out, with no, you know, sick pay or contingency pay or anything like that. It was just one day they were employed, the next day they weren't. They had 6 and 8 year old sons, and the rest of their life really falls apart from there. So she gets sick and starts experiencing symptoms of the coronavirus immediately after. Her landlord starts knocking on the door demanding rent money, and there was a moratorium on evictions placed in Austin. But as I've reported, in many places where these moratoriums exist, you know, they don't necessarily apply to undocumented workers who have landlords who want to collect their money and aren't really worried about their well-being, because the undocumented folks, they tend to be too scared to go to the authorities to fight back and say, hey, my landlord is trying to illegally evict me. That was the case for Enriqueta. So when she was facing this immense pressure to pay rent, she was too scared to report it because she didn't want to be separated from her children and deported. And so what she ended up doing was just fleeing with her kids. And she's been bouncing around from home to home ever since. She was sleeping in a living room of one of the cousins of her husband for a while on a blow-up mattress. And basically her husband, you know, seemed to experienced such extreme stress from the situation that he started drinking, she told me, excessively, and he eventually left her on her own to take care of the kids. She's had no income since then. Her kids dropped out of school for the last couple of months because the house they were staying in had no internet access. They were hardly getting any sleep because they were sleeping on an air mattress in a living room. People were coming in and out of the house. You know, every time somebody got up to get a drink of water, it would wake them up. And eventually, the city of Austin did find out about her living situation. It was reported to the mayor's office by her son's school, and the city helped them move into a new apartment. They were subletting at the time my story published, a bedroom in a new apartment, but again, with no lease and no protection and no income. Already, that situation has become stressful. You know, the landlord was beginning to pressure her and demanding money that she didn't have, and so she's actually back now out with her two children, staying with yet another friend and looking for another place to stay. Her situation is very precarious. And I should say, this entire time of the pandemic, the family has been relying completely on food donated by her children's school in order to survive. So she's really got, you know, at various times when I've been on the phone with her, no money in her purse, maybe $5 or $10 in her purse. That's really it. And she's really thinking about, you know, not just how are we going to get through the next month, how are we going to pay rent, but how are we going to get through today? You know, how am I going to get my kids enough food just to eat today?
So, Kimberly, Caitlin just expertly laid out what happens when a domestic worker loses their job. But there's also a risk that many of these workers face entering homes in this moment of the coronavirus. Do you know whether or not employers are following the CDC guidelines when it comes to providing protective gear for their workers?
That was one of the questions that we asked in the survey, and what we found was very alarming. The women who responded to the survey reported that 73% reported that they have not received personal protective equipment from their employers, and that percentage was much higher for undocumented workers.
And what we're talking about here are things like having hand sanitizer available, right, and having masks available.
Right, protective clothing, anything that would really reduce exposure and, you know, prevent the spread of germs.
If a worker gets sick, Kimberly, what kind of healthcare can they access?
What we saw was that 51% of the respondents to our survey said that they don't have medical insurance at all. And the numbers were particularly alarming for undocumented workers. In Miami, 100% of the Black immigrant workers who responded to our survey said that they did not have medical insurance. The numbers were also much higher for undocumented workers than their documented counterparts in Massachusetts and New York City. In New York City, 83% of undocumented workers do not have access to medical insurance. In Massachusetts, it was 42%.
Caitlin, some of this is, we've touched on this briefly, but some of this is reminding me of the public charge rule that's been implemented by the Trump administration here in regards to undocumented workers. Could you explain for our listeners what that was and how it might factor into the services that these workers, particularly those who are undocumented, may not be able to access?
Absolutely. It's definitely related. So your listeners may remember the public charge rule the Trump administration introduced is one that's designed to penalize anybody here in the country without legal status for using any type of public benefits, really, whether it comes to housing or it comes to food stamps or it comes to anything related to their health care. Any use of public benefits and support can be used against an immigrant who is later trying to adjust their status and become legal and obtain legal permanent residency. And so this created a chilling effect, which we've talked about all over the country. And it really affects every sector of American life because it highly discourages the use of public benefits. And that's definitely coming into play right now. But even beyond that, some nonprofit groups called together money to try to issue grants to fill in the gaps where the federal money just didn't exist for certain populations of people. But there's a real fear of taking advantage of any of that support because the thinking is that it could later be used against someone.
What is it that employers can do now? And by employers, I mean anyone who is hiring a home health aide, nanny help, any one of these domestic workers. What should people who are doing that be thinking about in order to protect these workers?
I think the first thing is to see them as human beings and as workers. They're not members of your family with whom you can have more informal arrangements. That, you know, you have to see yourself as an employer and those that you employ as people that work for you, and that you should be providing the same sort of standards of care that you would expect for yourself. Be that, you know, PPE in times like this, a contract that dictates how much and when people are paid. Wage theft is a big problem. The scope of work that they're asked to perform and that they agree to perform doesn't shift and change. And that should there be a need to reduce their hours or to terminate their employment, there should be fairness in that proposition, including advance notice. Most domestic workers who find themselves in that situation, as Caitlin mentioned, it's a phone call or a text that you get, and that there's no opportunity for you to be left out.
Kimberly Freeman Brown is co-author of the report Notes from the Storm, Black Immigrant Domestic Workers in the Time of COVID-19 from the Institute for Policy Studies. And Caitlin Dickerson is an immigration reporter for the New York Times. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Last week, the Labor Department released its jobs report, which saw the unemployment rate fall to 11.1%, down from 14.7% in April. But with coronavirus cases once again peaking in cities across the country, some states are rethinking their reopening strategies, which could force employers to once again close their doors. Meanwhile, emergency federal unemployment benefits are set to expire at the end of the month, and millions of Americans have been relying on those funds to stay afloat. Joining me now is Gina Smilek, Federal Reserve and economy reporter for the New York Times. Gina, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thanks for having me on.
These numbers are always interesting, Gina. What do they really tell us about who's working and who's not working?
I think they tell us several things about who's working and who's not working. One is just that a huge number of people, compared to where we were in February, are not on the job. You know, we were seeing unemployment below 4% at 50-year lows, and now we are seeing it above the highest level it ever hit in the Great Recession. And so I think a huge number of people are still out of work, and increasingly we're seeing them report that they are permanently out of work instead of just on temporary layoff. Some of the really hard hit sectors include things that you would think of, you know, restaurants, service sector work, anything that's really high touch and involves a lot of human interaction, obviously is being really affected by this pandemic.
What do we know about whether Black and Latino populations have been affected more by unemployment? Because those jobs that you just mentioned do tend to be filled by communities of color and low-income folks.
Absolutely. I think this is the pandemic recession has been almost unique in how hard it has hit really vulnerable populations. And I think that one of the reasons for real concern going forward is some of that hit looks like it could be more lasting than for communities that are a little bit more privileged to begin with. You know, I think what we've seen is a lot of service sector jobs disappearing and some without much prospect for return. So if you think about casinos, or if you think about restaurants and sort of airports and some of these institutions that have really been hit hard by the pandemic, those jobs are heavily populated by people in communities of color. And so the real concern is that as those jobs disappear and as they don't come back, and as some of them are permanently eliminated in the churn that the pandemic is going to create in the economy, and these populations that already had relatively low savings rates and were in a relatively weaker labor market position to begin with, are going to end up being disproportionately sort of tossed out of jobs on a permanent basis and really struggle to become sort of re-enfranchised in the labor market as a result.
Gina, those who were lucky enough to hold on to their jobs or to be employed again, are they seeing the same wages that they were seeing pre-pandemic?
No. So this has been, I think, one of the most fascinating aspects of this story. Folks who kept their jobs through the pandemic have reported wage cuts. The reason that is so unusual is employers usually shy away from cutting wages at basically all costs. Generally, what we've seen in recessions is employers are much more likely to fire employees than they are to reduce wages. And the reason for that is that it is really hard to maintain morale while cutting wages. You know, you're going to have a much more productive workforce if you convince them that they are valued employees who you kept at all costs, than if you sort of reduce wages across the board. And while you didn't fire anybody, now everybody who works for you is relatively unhappy. This recession has been very unique in the case, in the instance that, you know, employers have been sort of rapidly decreasing wages. And it seems like employees are getting behind this on the understanding that, you know, these are such unusual circumstances.
You know, one of the reasons I'm interested in this is, you know, we hear about job numbers all the time. They go up, they go down. But one of the most striking things about this moment, Gina, are the images of the long lines that we're seeing across the country of Americans lining up and waiting for unemployment offices to open. What is going on there? Can you tell us, are unemployment offices just inundated? What's happening?
One thing that was a real feature, I think, especially early on in this pandemic, is that a lot of state unemployment insurance systems just weren't particularly well equipped to handle the influx of unemployed people. And, you know, partially because this was such an unprecedented event. You know, you don't usually have a situation where a huge portion of businesses just suddenly close their doors and suddenly a huge chunk of the population is looking for some sort of help to make it through that period. And so states were not particularly well equipped. They were working on old systems, and there were extensive backlogs of unemployment insurance claims that really we're still seeing even now just being processed. I think one place where you can very clearly see this overhang is unemployment insurance claims, which come out each Thursday morning, continue to be very elevated, you know, at numbers that are far below what we were seeing at sort of the peak of the crisis back in March and April, but still numbers that would have been completely unprecedented prior to the crisis. You know, we're still well into the millions, which is pretty crazy. If you had sort of zoomed forward from January, you would have, if you didn't know what had happened, you would think that there was a massive crisis just hitting now. And so I think clearly this has been a real issue throughout this period.
One of the most frustrating things, I think, watching this, Gina, is that a lot of Americans are out of work through no fault of their own. This was something that, as you said, was just an unprecedented crisis that we've all sort of been struggling with. And so I'm wondering, you mentioned earlier that Congress was sort of debating whether or not to extend unemployment benefits for fear, at least, that people might almost begin to rely on them. But the question I have is, a lot of Americans lost their jobs through no fault of their own. Some of these jobs are never coming back. How would Congress justify not extending unemployment benefits?
Right. So I think one of the So to be clear, it seems like the debate in Congress is mostly about the generosity of those benefits. And I think the question in a lot of people's minds is whether you get to a point where employers are trying to hire folks back, but it just doesn't make any sense for somebody who's making $600 a week in enhanced unemployment insurance benefits to come back into a low-wage job. Now, there are some people on one side of this debate who would say, you know, if employers want to compete with that $600 a week, they should pay up and pay more. There are other people on the opposite side of this debate who say the sort of arithmetic of that simply doesn't work. There are jobs for which employers don't make enough off of sort of the product of that job to pay that much extra. And so I think there's this debate that we're going to really see play out in coming months. I think that one of the really big issues in that debate is whether we're even in a strong enough labor market to worry about it. So it could be the case that, sure, there are plenty of people who are not going to come back to work with that $600 enhancement. It will make more sense for them to stay home. But there are so many people unemployed that for every person who doesn't want to take that job because of the $600 enhancement, there are several other unemployed people who will happily take that job because they want the security. And if that's the case, then the entire argument about the enhancement becomes a lot less powerful. I think we're going to hear a lot about this in the weeks ahead. The end of July is when those robust unemployment enhancement benefits are set to expire. So this is something that people are going to have to deal with in a pretty short order here.
Gina, how much do the unemployment numbers reflect the number of people who, for example, during the coronavirus peak were either furloughed or, you know, sort of temporarily not working, and now that businesses are starting to reopen are back working? Is that accounted for in the numbers that we're seeing?
I don't think we have a super clear idea of exactly what is going on here. We do know that backlogs are clearly influencing the number. Bloomberg actually did a very good story about sort of the counting issues that are happening. And one thing that I think was a really big takeaway from that piece, it was written by Katya Dmitrieva, if anyone's interested in looking it up. But I think one of the really interesting takeaways from that piece was that this is done in such sort of a patchwork way, and these claims are filed in such a state by state and sort of uncoordinated basis that it's really hard to paint with one broad brush what's happening in any individual state because every system is so different, and that makes this complicated, and it makes it really hard to sort of trace the trends on a week by week basis and understand clearly what is going on here.
And finally, are there any industries that have proven to be more resilient during this economy that you see as potential bright spots for employment going forward?
I think you can almost trace this one in the stock market, weirdly enough. The stock market does not always trace the economy, but in this case, I think you can see that really the tech companies have been the winners in this crisis. We've seen, you know, I think we can all, this all resonates with anybody who's been stuck at home because, you know, your Netflix subscription is probably getting a lot more use these days than it was before. But it's everything. It's Amazon, it's Netflix, it's Google, it's sort of the whole suite of technology companies that were already pretty important to our everyday lives that just became increasingly indispensable as we all got stuck in our apartments and houses. And so I think those are a really bright sector of the economy. I think also anything that helps with connectivity from a distance, so think of the Zooms of the world, I think have been a real bright spot here. As we've discussed previously, though, there's a real problem with that reshuffling in that the people who work for those companies, A, there are a lot fewer of them, and B, they tend to be a lot more high-skilled and often from sort of privileged demographics. So I think the real concern is the labor market hangover you see there really disproportionately hurts people who are already at a disadvantage.
Gina Smilek is a Federal Reserve and economy reporter for the New York Times. Gina, thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
I got my potato
on Radiolab,
and I'm looking at it and I'm holding it.
We consider the mundane.
It's a handsome shape.
And stop to smell the potatoes.
Been telling people about my potato. They're always surprised, and I say, you wouldn't understand.
Small potatoes on Radiolab.
It's my friend.
Listen wherever you get podcasts.
This summer, many communities are restricting beach and pool access because of COVID-19. But many of those restrictions could keep some families out of the water.
There's been a long history of exclusionary practices in many suburban and outlying communities, not just in the New York metro area, but across the U.S. And oftentimes, these had a disproportionate impact on working families and people of color.
Andrew Carl is a professor of history and African American studies at the University of Virginia and author of Free the Beaches, the story of Ned Cole and the battle for America's most exclusive shoreline. And according to Andrew, there are a few different types of barriers to beach and pool access right now.
We've seen two parallel developments happening this summer. One is that many cities and towns have been forced to close their public swimming pools or public beaches, not just out of public health concerns, but also out of budgetary ones, that the coronavirus and pandemic has really decimated local budgets and forced many communities to keep their pools closed this summer. And at the same time, we've been seeing private clubs, private beaches, or wealthier communities that can't afford to keep their facilities open this summer, adopting more aggressive practices to keep non-members or non-residents out.
We're seeing a lot of that activity out on Long Island. In fact, there's one beach I know that increased its cost per car from $20 a car to $50 a car. How much has economics played in the disparities that we're seeing in terms of access?
It's been a huge factor, but also I think it's important to note that oftentimes these types of fees and charges are not just about raising revenue. It's also about keeping certain families who cannot afford to enter out. And I think this is important to recognize, that the use of beach access fees and other charges that are oftentimes much higher for non-residents has been an exclusionary measure that has been used often in the past.
A lot of this is socioeconomics, and I'm wondering if you can tell us what are some of the more subtle and more explicit policies that have been used to discriminate as far as beach access is concerned.
Going back to the early 20th century, when we began to see public swimming pools and beaches emerge across the U.S., they became often flashpoints of racial conflict, and ones in which socially advantaged communities adopted measures that were designed quite explicitly to exclude people of color. You know, we saw that clearly in the Jim Crow South, where there was explicit whites-only beaches, whites-only swimming pools. But we also saw in places like the Northeast, in states like Connecticut, where beaches were ostensibly non-racial, but in practice, oftentimes were racially exclusionary, whether it be resident-only ordinances or policies that made it much more cost prohibitive for non-residents. You have, and this as well, began to increase in direct relation to the increasing diversity of neighboring cities. So if, say, you're living in an all-white suburb that grew during the post-war era, you oftentimes would see, along with exclusion in housing markets, you would also see exclusion in public places of recreation, that the two kind of went hand in hand.
And as we mentioned earlier, we are now in the middle of a global pandemic, which has gotten many city, state governments thinking about whether to open public pools and public beaches and how far they should go. Do they allow swimming? Do they enforce social distancing? You wrote an op-ed in the New York Times, Andrew, with the headline, "Who Will Get to Swim This Summer?" We're now in July. Who's gotten to swim this summer?
Well, by and large, it's been families who are members of either private clubs or have the ability to seek out more remote locations, whether it be spending a week on a lake or having access to other private facilities. But those who have relied primarily on public beaches or public pools have been really adversely affected. By some estimates, over one third of all public swimming pools in America are closed for this summer. That number could actually be even higher. A real concern here is that those who rely on public places of recreation have found it increasingly difficult to access any bodies of water for their families, for their children. And this is, again, something that is a really important part of being able to not just enjoy the summer, but for people's individual and community health.
I want to dig a little bit more into that, because we did a story here on The Takeaway a couple weeks ago where I was sort of prompted by many of the local news reports about people who were buying pools for their backyards because of the pandemic. And it just got me thinking about so many people who don't live in houses, who won't have access to swimming pools, who will be essentially crowded and hot this summer in a city like New York. Is there or should there be a right to outdoor recreational space?
I believe so. I think that the United Nations defined recreation as a basic human right. And I think it's well understood that so long as people take precautions, outdoor activities are not only safe but necessary for coping with the stress of the pandemic, as well as the daily stress of racism in America that has oftentimes only been compounded by the struggle to access outdoor space. Summers, especially in cities, have long been sites of tension and conflict over access to outdoor recreational space. And I believe it is rooted in this tension between the real human need for getting outdoors, especially during hot summer months, and the increased privatization of public space that has made it inaccessible for many American families.
I'm wondering how you see this fitting into the larger reckoning with systemic racism and this uprising that we've seen across the country right now. Is there any pushback to what we're seeing in terms of access to local pools, beaches, recreational spaces?
We've seen in the past real efforts to ensure that the public has right to public space. And beaches have long been a space that have really been at the center of these broader struggles over the public's right to common areas. And because, for one, America's coastlines are legally public land, but the public's right to access them has been severely restricted, whether it be local communities placing ordinances on accessing beach space or beachfront property owners seeking to fence off areas. And so I think that we've continued to see how this struggle over public recreation is really a struggle over the right to the commons and over the right to access what are common resources that should be available to everyone. I think certainly that we should put in place measures to ensure that people practice social distancing in these spaces. We can find ways to regulate access to public space in a way that ensures public health but doesn't simply compound existing inequities. What we're seeing this summer is that the burden of public health concerns is being placed on one segment of the population and not others.
Andrew Carl is a professor of history and African American studies at the University of Virginia and the author of Free the Beaches. Andrew, thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me.
The oil industry was dealt a major blow on Monday when a district court said the Dakota Access Pipeline must shut down by August 5th for an environmental review that could last well into 2021. The Standing Rock Sioux Tribe and environmental groups have spent years opposing the pipeline. And that decision comes just days after the energy companies behind the Atlantic Coast Natural Gas Pipeline canceled that project after years of legal delays. Ellen Gilmer is a senior legal reporter for Bloomberg Law, and she joins me now. Ellen, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thanks for having me, Tanzina.
So, why the sudden turnaround in the Dakota Access Pipeline?
So, Monday's decision was something that was truly years in the making. This is a case the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe, the Cheyenne River Sioux Tribe, and a few other tribes filed lawsuits back in 2016. So they've been trying to fight this pipeline since before construction began. They were unsuccessful in stopping it on the front end, but this district court in Washington, D.C. identified some flaws in the permit that the federal government issued for the pipeline and finally decided that the result of those flaws in the permit meant shutting down the pipeline while the government does another environmental review.
Ellen, you said that they were unsuccessful on the front end, and I want to remind listeners that we're talking about, if some may recall, many of the protests that were happening at this Dakota Access Pipeline. Is that correct?
Absolutely. So a lot of listeners might recall back in 2016, thousands of people descended on Standing Rock Indian Reservation in North Dakota near this water body where the pipeline would cross. And that's really the area that's of most concern to members of the tribes. It's about a half a mile from the Standing Rock Indian Reservation. And there were people who were camped out there for months to show their opposition to this project, largely indigenous advocates, also of a large contingent of environmental activists and just other opponents of the pipeline. And so they were on the ground doing this advocacy, and at the same time, they were in court pushing back on the pipeline. They just didn't have success in court until later.
When it comes to pipelines like the Dakota Access Pipeline, which go through Native land, is that factored into the judge's decision? Are we looking at the sovereignty of that land itself as it belongs to tribal communities?
So it's complicated. Dakota Access does not go through the Standing Rock Reservation, but it does go through historic land, ancestral homelands of all of the Lakota people. And in that case, there are certainly tribal treaty rights involved in the litigation, especially in regards to how the pipeline could affect the water supply that the tribes rely on. So that's how that comes into play in that context. And the judge has required the federal government to take a closer look at how the pipeline affects those tribal treaty rights to that water and to hunt and fish in that area. But the crux of the decision this week is a little broader, and it's all about the National Environmental Policy Act, which is a federal law that basically says, when the government approves a big project, it has to look before it leaps. It has to look at the environmental impacts before it goes forward. It doesn't mean it can't have environmental impacts, but it means those have to be fully understood. And so the conclusion the judge made here was the Army Corps of Engineers, which is the agency that has jurisdiction here, the Army Corps didn't properly consider all of the potential impacts.
This pipeline has existed prior to the Trump administration. I want to be clear with our listeners on that. And so this is an issue that's been longstanding under multiple administrations. But under the Trump administration, many of these environmental protections and laws are either being gutted or rewritten. What effect does that have, if any, on what you're describing here, which is the environmental impact that a project could have? I mean, are those laws still in place? Are those recommendations still in place under the Trump administration?
All the laws are still in place for sure. What the Trump administration is doing is trying to update various regulations which control kind of how these laws are implemented. So the Trump administration is trying to streamline all of these different approvals, environmental reviews especially, for big infrastructure projects like oil and gas pipelines. And yes, the Dakota Access Pipeline was originally approved under the Obama administration back in 2016. But the Obama administration, after seeing all of the tribal opposition to the project, took a step back and it withheld a final permit for the project and said, let's take a closer look at this. When President Trump took office, one of his first actions was to say, no, we are definitely moving forward on Dakota Access and also on the Keystone XL pipeline. Both of these are oil pipelines. So this has been a big priority for the administration to just get these two projects through and also to make it easier for all of these other kind of projects to get built and not get bogged down by the various environmental requirements that are laid out in federal law.
In the name of transparency, we should also explain what the Trump administration's relationship is to the company behind the Dakota Access Pipeline.
Kelsey Warren is the CEO of Energy Transfer, which is the company that built and operates Dakota Access. Kelsey Warren is a big Trump supporter, has hosted campaign rallies for the president. So they have a good relationship. Definitely the president is supportive of Kelsey Warren's enterprise, and Kelsey Warren has been a big booster of the president's policy goals.
This project at least will be under review until at least 2021, at which point we may have a new president in office. We may not. We've just described how President Trump is dealing with this. Let's talk a little bit if we have a President Biden at some point by 2021. Has he said anything about how he would handle these types of projects going forward?
So he's been pretty explicit about moving away from oil and gas production on federal lands. I haven't seen as much about specific pipelines, but it's definitely something that court watchers and policy watchers are looking at and thinking if there is a Biden administration, it would be maybe inclined to not grant any kind of final reapproval of the Dakota Access Pipeline. But it's hard to say right now. We should also note that it's possible Dakota Access and the Trump administration could successfully appeal Monday's court decision, and they could keep the pipeline operating. And if the pipeline is still operating, makes it a little bit tougher for a future administration to change course. Still totally possible, but it changes the status quo, makes it a little bit harder to just turn those valves off and turn the oil off.
Ellen Gilmer is a senior legal reporter for Bloomberg Law. Ellen, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
As protests against police brutality and racial injustice continue, books about race and anti-racism have been topping the bestseller lists for weeks. Ibram X. Kendi's How to Be an Anti-Racist, Ijeoma Oluyo's So You Want to Talk About Race, and Robin DiAngelo's White Fragility are all in short supply.
People are listening to the moment, want to know what they can do, want to know more about history of systemic racism in America and what their role is in any of that. My name is Jasmine Guillory. I'm the New York Times bestselling author of 5 novels, including Party of Two.
Jasmine says that to better understand the wholeness of Black lives, you might also want to consider fiction by and about Black people. But nonfiction books are still a good start.
I think they're certainly useful in their place, but I worry that people think that their only job is to read one book and then that's it. Whereas I think this is a lifelong thing that we all have to do. Reading one book about not being racist is not going to be the whole work that you have to do.
How do you see the role of fiction in this moment?
You know, fiction is often the way we learn about things in the world. Fiction lets you live in the mind and the world and the life of someone else, whether you're a child and reading that in a picture book, or growing up as a teenager and reading about other teenagers like you, or as an adult reading about all sorts of different people and lives that are different from yours, or similar to yours in certain ways, but different in others. And so reading fiction that's not just about white people, people in your own country, but fiction about Black people and Black lives does a lot to change your perspective.
You said reading fiction about that's not about white people and white people's lives. And I just think how much of the fiction I read growing up was about white people and white America. And I wonder how has that landscape changed in your opinion about just in terms of what's available to people today?
There are a lot more books about Black children out there today. There are not as many as there should be. Publishing needs to do a lot harder work on this. There have been studies that show the numbers of books that are about Black children and, you know, getting older, books about Black people that are available. So that this is part of publishing's job, too, is that they need to put those books out. Bookstores need to make them available. And I think that is something that we're seeing. You know, bookstores have seen the rush on anti-racism books, but there's also been people reading fiction. And so I think, you know, I have seen parents want to buy books about Black kids for their kids of all colors. And I think that's really important.
Also, you know, there is research here that shows that fiction improves empathy. Empathy is something we talk a lot about here on The Takeaway, as far as the sort of growing gap in empathy that I see across the country. So how is it that fiction can improve empathy?
People in books make decisions and have experiences that you would not, decisions you would not make, experiences that you have never even dreamed of. And while you live in their head and their world, you understand what they've gone through. And so when you can go out into the world and see other people who sometimes you see them making decisions and saying things that you wouldn't, but you can think like, well, maybe something happened to them that doesn't happen to me, or maybe they came to this from a different perspective. And so it gives you more empathy and, you know, makes you stop and think about other people and other people's lives in a way that can only be good.
One of the things we've also talked about on The Takeaway recently is joy and how people are capturing joy amid the very difficult moment that we're living in. And one of the things that you write a lot about is, or you capture a lot about in your books, is the complexity and joy that lives in many of your Black female characters. Talk a little bit about that, and specifically the role that romance novels play in doing that.
Absolutely. I think, you know, it is important to recognize, like, when we talk about Black Lives Matter, Black lives don't just matter when we're being killed by the police or when something bad is happening in our lives. Like, Black joy matters too. And so, you know, in diving into romance novels and seeing Black women flourishing and having like jobs that they like and relationships that they like and friends and people loving them, that reflects the joy that I see around me. You know, I find a lot of joy in being a Black woman, in my friendships, in my family, in the children I know. And so I want to reflect that in my books, and I want to read more books that reflect that and have that out in the world. I think people too often think of, you know, racism or Black people in America as a problem, you know, as racism overcoming everything in our lives. And that is not the case. Racism is a problem, and it's something that we should talk about, but we should also pay attention to like all of the wonderful things there are about being a Black woman, about being a Black person in America. And so I think romance novels can really reflect that joy.
To your point, so much of our conversation that's happening in the nonfiction world, in the news world in particular, is really looking at the trauma of Black Americans that's been inflicted on Black Americans since the founding of this country. And that is a heavy and necessary conversation to have. But I do think it's interesting that this idea about, you know, just really seeing joy and fulfillment and the entire spectrum of human experience being presented through the lens of Black characters. When you're writing about Black characters in your books, what are some of the things that are most important for you to capture outside of just of joy? What else are you looking to capture?
You know, I mean, some of the things that I'm looking to capture are I love my family. I have a very big, sprawling, loud family on both sides. And that is one thing that I really enjoy capturing in books, is seeing all of the differences of Black families, of Black relationships, and of like having the way that we move through the world, right? I mean, being a Black woman in the corporate world or in any kind of job is a distinct experience. And so these are conversations that I've had with my Black female friends about how do I do this? Which is, they'll give me very different advice than anyone else will, and their advice will usually be the right one. And so these are things that I want to capture in my books about the distinct way that it is about moving through the world as a Black woman in America.
Because we don't often know, I mean, one of the things I think when we think about media and media, ethnic media, quote unquote, or Black media, if you will, is that, you know, often white readers or white media consumers won't consume that media because they say, well, that's not for me. You know, that magazine isn't for me, or that show isn't for me, whatever that means. Do you find that the same thing, there's less of that happening in publishing? That people are just picking up books because they're intrigued by the premise and not worrying so much about, or not being as concerned about race, the race of the leading characters, for example?
You know, I think a lot of this depends on the way publishing acts towards these books, right? I think sometimes publishing has definitely spun books as like the Black experience, or this is the, you know, these are the books for Black kids. And so I want publishing to get away from that, to show that these are, you know, these are books for all kids. These are books for, you know, all people who want to read a romance. These are people for all books, you know, books for all people who want to read literary fiction. And so, I think it has changed in relatively recent years. I've seen, you know, bookstores definitely treating books in different ways and just putting them out on the counter or pushing books on little kids of all races. But I think there definitely is a way to go, especially in the books that publishing decides to actually publish. So I hope that there will be more of that, of just listening to experiences and saying this is a great book, and then letting those books come out into the world.
Simon & Schuster today just announced publisher Dana Kennedy, who is a Black woman who I worked with over at the New York Times and is now at that imprint. And I'm wondering, at the very highest levels, when you look at the publishing industry, what do you see needs to change? Is that really where the power needs to shift?
You know, I think it is it is something that needs to shift at every level. One of the things that I now know, but I didn't understand when I first got in, is how many different people work in a publishing company, right? Like, there's the publicist, you know, the publishing team, the marketing, the sales team. Like, all of these people need to believe in your book and push it to all of their contacts. And I think that is something that I've heard from a lot of people. Well, the sales team didn't really believe in the book, so Barnes & Noble didn't take it. Or, like, you know, marketing didn't throw a lot of push behind that book, so it didn't get a lot of buzz. And these are the things that need to change. We need more people in all of those teams, and in all of the, like, throughout publishing, to recognize that these are stories that can make an impact for everyone.
Jasmine Guillory is the New York Times best-selling author of 5 books, including The Wedding Date and The New Party of Two. Jasmine, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you so much.
That's all for us today. Thanks again for continuing to listen. And we have a programming note for tomorrow. As the uprising for racial justice continues around the country and calls to defund the police grow louder, The Takeaway is hosting a roundtable discussion on the future of policing tomorrow, Wednesday, July 8th at 11 a.m. Eastern on Facebook. You can follow us on social media for more details on how to join the conversation. We're at The Takeaway, and I'll see you there. Matt Katz is stepping in for me tomorrow, and I'll be back in the host chair on Thursday. Thanks again for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.